that galaxies are active, that they actually eject material, and this material has some very surprising properties. And when you study the properties of this material, you find that the one of the most strangest aspects of this material is its redshift, and the redshift cannot be the conventional interpretation of redshift, and therefore it almost directly leads to the fact that they cannot have a Big Bang cosmology, and it leads to contradictions of the current relativity theory. It leads to essentially a new a view of physics, and that I'll come to at the end. Now, the fact that galaxies are active came as a surprise to most people, and I think perhaps even today many conventional astronomers haven't come to terms with this concept, because in the 1950s, at the end of the Second World War, it was accidentally discovered that galaxies were emitting radio waves. And I was finishing my PhD at Caltech at the time, and the reports began to come in about measurements of radio spots in the sky, and they were they came in doubles, they came in pairs. And I remember very well the senior professors at Caltech saying that these pairs of radio spots, and this is a radio map taken, a picture taken in radio waves, that these radio spots had nothing to do with this galaxy in the center. And it seemed very strange that they wouldn't immediately recognize that they were associated with this galaxy in the center, and the galaxy itself is much larger. But then when the radio maps got very good, and this is a recent map from the Very Large Array in New Mexico, you could see the thin jet leading from the galaxy out into these radio spots. And then, of course, people then had to admit that these galaxies were really emitting, ejecting clouds of plasma, which gave off radio waves. At that time, also in the beginning, there were strong beliefs that these were in our own galaxy, that they were local. I think the Cavendish lab here and Martin Ryle were very strong adherents to this. But then when it was discovered that these had high redshifts, then they had to admit that they were extragalactic. So here we have extragalactic objects, a galaxy ejecting material in both directions. And I think this is the first conclusion that I want to leave you with, that galaxies actually eject material in opposite directions. Now, in 1966, I had made a complete study with the 200-inch telescope of peculiar galaxies, galaxies that were disrupted. And I found radio sources around them. And the obvious conclusion was that the reason that they were disrupted, torn apart, is because they had in the process of ejecting these radio plasmas. And it turned out that some of these radio spots were identified with quasars, which were discovered in 1963. And that the startling thing about the quasars was that they had high redshifts, which in the conventional interpretation meant that they were receding with high velocities away from us, and therefore that they were out at the edge of the universe. This is the expanding universe solution. But if they were connected with my peculiar galaxies, then of course they couldn't be out at the edge of the universe. They had to be in close, and there had to be another reason for the redshift. So in 1967, 1968, I turned the problem around, and instead of looking around my peculiar galaxies for radio sources, some of which turned out to be quasars, I looked for pairs of radio sources in the sky. And you see here is a radio source, a very strong radio source here, and a radio strong here, and it's the only pair in the sky in that region. And you look between them, and lo and behold, there's a galaxy, IC 1767. Now, at the time that I did this in 1967, it was not known that these were quasars, but then later it turned out to be that they were quasars, and this is the redshift, 6.62 and 0.67. That's in terms of delta lambda over lambda, where one is about, well, this is getting up to a large fraction of the velocity of light. So these are fairly high redshifts. And as you notice, they're quite similar. And as you'll see, the redshifts of quasars vary quite a bit, so it's very unusual for them to be so similar in redshift. This was already a very controversial result, because when the quasars were discovered in 1963, there was a momentary debate as to whether they could be close by. And then people said, well, no, we don't know where the redshifts come from if they're close by, so they must be out at the edge of the universe. They must be the most luminous things that we've ever measured, and they'll help in the cosmological problem. And everybody got used to that. So already in a few years, 1967, 68, this was too controversial to publish in the conventional journals, and it was published in the Armenian journal, which was edited by Ambar Tsumian, who was a pioneer in accepting these pairings. So now the evidence built up over the years, and I want to flash forward to about 1997 and show you the next step. And that occurred when the X-ray telescopes went up into orbit, in satellite X-ray telescopes. And it turned out that they were very good at picking out quasars. Now this is what's called a Seyfert galaxy. And it's because it has a very brilliant point in the center. This is an optical photograph with an X-ray map overlaid. And this is a famous Seyfert galaxy, NGC 4258. It's very bright and very active. And it's got a bright nucleus, optical nucleus here. And here you see the X-ray isophotes put onto the image. And you see there's a lot of X-ray activity in there. And this galaxy is known to be ejecting, because you can see it in the radio. You can see its radio plumes are coming out. You can see optical evidence of ejection and so forth. When the X-ray map was uncovered, the person came to me from the adjoining institute and said, here are two X-ray sources across the minor axis. It looks like they've been ejected. And of course, immediately, I had this deep photograph that I'd taken with a 4-meter telescope in Kitt Peak. Immediately, we saw there was an optical object here, a blue optical object here, and a blue optical object there. And we knew there were quasars. We didn't have to measure them. But nevertheless, in order to make sure, in order to publish them, in order to have this accepted, we had to get them measured. But no one would actually measure them. And it was deliberately avoided to measure these things for a couple of years. Finally, Margaret Burbidge, who you know well in England, because she was the director of the Royal Greenwich Observatory for a while, president of the American Astronomical Society and so forth, she measured them in the Lick Telescope in California. And they turned out, in fact, to be two quasars, one of about redshift 4/10 and one redshift 6/10. And you see that's very important, because the intrinsic redshift is about 0.55, and one of them is coming towards you with about a tenth, and one is going away from you with about a tenth. So you can see the ejection velocity in there. The interesting thing is that after Margaret got these redshifts, she wrote up the paper and sent it to the Astrophysical Journal of Letters, and it was turned down. And I was shocked, and I think a lot of people were shocked, and she just immediately withdrew the paper and then submitted it to the European Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and it was published. But this is, I think, indicative of the resistance that has come from the astronomical community, the conventional community, the resistance to these observational facts. And we haven't even started really on the interpretation. To jump ahead now further, and omitting a lot of individual objects that were observed, I want to show you this statistical result, because the conventional astronomers always argued, well, there's this example and that example, but you have to have a complete sample and you have to do a statistical study. And what you see here is I went to the X-ray archives, because the institute I was with had access to these archives, and all the Seyferts that had been observed, the brightest ones between 8th magnitude and 12.9, almost all of them had been observed because they were strong X-ray sources, but nobody had looked around them at the X-ray sources around them. And if you do that, You see there's an excess of X-ray sources here. The dashed line represents the control field. So around these bright Seyfords, there was this excess of X-ray, point X-ray sources. And we know from experience that these point X-ray sources are going to be 99% quasars and of the redshift that I've just shown you. So immediately you could see from this that there was a 7.5 sigma chance of it being accidental, say a 1 in 10 million, greater than 1 in 10 million significance to this observation. And this was published in the European Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics, but the result has been pretty much ignored. Well, very much ignored. However, I think we can go ahead and begin to see what it means. And I'll show you a few more examples of individual objects. This is a Seyfert galaxy, NGC 4235. And here it is, edge on here, where this is the minor axis coming out. Here is a quasar, redshift 0.334. And here's a quasar, a special kind of a quasar called a BLAC object at 0.136. And you see they're roughly paired across here and coming out along the minor axis. And the redshifts, of course, are much different. These are high redshifts. The redshift of the Seyfert galaxy is very low, 0.007. Just to show you another example, so you get the feel of how these things actually work. Here's NGC 2639, another Seyfert galaxy. And these are X-ray maps. I should hasten to explain that. And these little points you see here are the actual individual X-ray photons that the satellite telescope records. So right here, there's a lot of X-ray photons coming in, and that coincides with an optical object, which turns out has this redshift. Again, these redshifts, I had measured this a number of years before, but then this one needed to be measured, and Margaret Burbidge again measured it. And here you see, extraordinarily, the exact, almost exact correspondence between the measured redshift, 0.307, 0.325. And we would argue that this is very unlikely to happen by chance, very, very unlikely. And it means that these high redshift quasars are actually associated with these low redshift galaxies, low redshift active galaxies. And I might also make the remark that the centers of these Seyfert galaxies are very active, optically active, and pouring out X-rays, and brilliant and compact. And that's the same description as a quasar. So that it's as if you took a piece of the nucleus of the galaxy and split it or ejected it out. So this is the similarity. You really couldn't associate it with anything else. Then came this, which I consider to be the Rosetta Stone of Seyfert's. And this is NGC 3516, a bright Seyfert galaxy, which is known to be active and ejecting. And I was able to get the X-ray map of this and say that and identify the 6 brightest X-ray sources in this field. And here they are, here, 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 and here. And so this is a complete sample of the brightest X-ray sources in this field. And again, we have this problem of how to measure these. And in this case, I was in Sri Lanka, and I met a friend of mine from the Hefei, University of Hefei in China. This is Dr. Chu. And he said he would try to get these quasars measured. And he did with the Beijing telescope, the 2.1 meter Beijing telescope. He measured these quasar redshifts. And every one of them turned out to be a quasar. And the reason I say it's a Rosetta Stone is because you can see the whole systematics of this ejection and the association in this one object. You notice the one nearest the Seyfert is a redshift very high, 2.1. And then the next one out is 1.40. And the next one out is 0.93. Next one 0.69 and 33. And then 0.089. So as you go out, away from the galaxy, the redshifts drop. Now this, I think, implies just clearly that as they go out, they age, and the redshift drops with the age. So that in the beginning, when this material is ejected, it has a high redshift, and as time goes by, the redshift drops. The other thing, which I'll talk about at the very end, is that these come in quantized steps. There's a formula for the the favored redshifts for quasars, and it goes 1.96, 1.41, 0.96, 0.60, 0.30, and 0.065. Those are the formulas. You can see these things are arranged according to their dropping redshifts and also to the discrete steps. And also, this line that you have drawn through here is not drawn through the points, but it's the minor axis of the galaxy. So you see that these things are coming out the minor axis. As fundamental and as striking as this paper was, it was sent to Nature magazine, and they rejected it without even reviewing it. It was eventually published in an Astrophysical Journal of Letters. Another example is this Seyfert 5985, and this came up because somebody pointed out that there was a quasar and a 0.8 redshift, 0.81, 2.4 arc seconds away from a galaxy of redshift 0.009, and they said that this was an accident. So I just happened to look in the neighborhood and found this bright Seyfert galaxy. There's another way of finding them. And these other quasars, again, along this line. And again, this is the minor axis of the galaxy. And it's not drawn through the points. I want to introduce another a factor in the puzzle now. And that is that as the redshifts drop, the objects become more luminous, and they evolve in every respect toward a companion galaxy. So that this central galaxy here is about 2,400 kilometers per second. These are somewhat higher. These are companion galaxies, 2,700, 2,800 kilometers per second. And they're along the same line of ejection. Now this, I think, is telling us something. And again, I think we can work just from the empirical observations. And this summarizes those empirical observations. Already in the 1960s, there was a Swedish astronomer in Mount Wilson and Palomar observatories that showed the companion galaxies were distributed along the minor axes of the central galaxies, and it was about plus or minus 35 degrees opening angle. Here we see the quasars, and now I'm summarizing what I've shown you. The quasars are spread about plus or minus 20 on the average from this. So the implication, I think, is clear that the quasars start out here at high redshift, drop in redshift as they go out, evolve into larger objects, into companion galaxies, which are much nearer the redshift of the parent galaxy. And this is what forms the groups of galaxies that we see in the sky. Because our local group of galaxies is dominant M31, and then the M33, our own galaxies and so forth, are out here. When they come out here, they stop at about a half a megaparsec out, and there's slight perturbations that prevent them from falling directly back, so that sort of spreads the distribution out. And this half a megaparsec radius, megaparsec, 3 million light years, is just the size of our local group of galaxies and galaxies around other SB galaxies like M81. So I think this is the building blocks of the universe, where these older, brighter galaxies create the new galaxies, which evolve into the families which we observe. This is summarized in another slide, which is also shown in my book, Seeing Red. And it just schematizes the fact that here's the parent galaxy along the minor axis. You're ejecting some new material. We'll argue this is new matter. At redshift, high redshift. The redshift is dropping. It's evolving into lower redshift quasars and then into companion galaxies and finally into normal companions, which, and this is another very controversial point, but they have systematically higher redshifts. The companion galaxies in our local group are all systematically higher redshift by 100, 200 kilometers per second. And this is an extraordinary result that shouldn't happen in conventional terms and hasn't been accepted, but it's come out in almost every group, and I'll show you further. Then this is another way of looking at it. In the beginning, they're not such strong X-ray sources. when they're out here, they begin to develop into very strong X-ray sources, and then they begin secondary ejections into multiple galaxies. And we'll see at the very end, I'll show you some clusters of X-ray sources and galaxy clusters. More on the subject of companion galaxies. This is a peculiar galaxy called ARP-105 because it's from the Atlas of Peculiar Galaxies number 105. Ambar Tsumian in the 1970s pointed that there was this ejection coming out exactly along this direction. Here's a quasar, redshift 2.2. The ejection in the other direction seems to have just torn through this spiral galaxy, and there's this big plume of material out here. And you see all these companion galaxies in the vicinity. Well, if you look at their redshifts, it's just like in our local group or in the M81 group, you see that the redshifts are systematically a few hundred kilometers per second higher. So here's the central galaxy, and here are the companions. And I think what you're seeing is that the companions are younger, and therefore they have still have a residual higher redshift. And this is going to be very important in the interpretation, the physics interpretation that we'll make in the end. I want to make one more set of remarks, however, about the ejection and the evolution of companion galaxies. And this is NGC 1232. It's an SC1 spiral galaxy in the southern hemisphere. And it's been, this is a photograph with a new very large telescope at Paranal, the ESO telescope, the four 8-meter telescopes at Paranal in Chile. And here's this spiral more or less face on. And here's this companion galaxy, which was always thought to be at the same distance. But then they discovered that they'd made a mistake in the redshift. And this is really a higher redshift companion galaxy, even though it clearly comes out of this spiral arm. You see, it fits back into here. And I would say that, in my opinion, the spiral arms represent ejection tracks. And that the ejection tracks, in this sense, are wound up. And this object here, which seems to be affecting the arm right here, has a redshift of a tenth the velocity of light. It's equal to 1/10, even though the redshift of this is very small. So it seems that this is an example of an ejection which tried to get out through the disk of the galaxy and was inhibited and stopped. And so it developed, it went through its evolution, instead of out here as a companion cloud of galaxies, it went through its evolution here, and it stopped at that point. So I think we'll see when the quasars try to get out through the dense part of the galaxy, they rip the galaxy apart. Now, this I have to show you for fun, because this was a very controversial object, came up in the early 1970s, and it's Markarian 205, which is this quasar here. And Markarian was an Armenian observer with an Armenian Schmidt. And NGC 4319, which is just being blown apart. You can see it's just coming apart. And the quasar is attached back here to the center by this filament, this luminous filament here. And this is 21,000 kilometers per second. This is 2,000 kilometers per second. Now, this was a source of tremendous controversy in the field, and people with big telescopes took this and said that the connection didn't exist. And I took it then with a bigger telescope and said it did exist. And then they said no, it didn't, and so forth. And the consensus finally was that it didn't exist, and it was too uncertain, and so forth and so on. But just recently on the web, there has appeared this picture, which I think is really marvelous. And that is because you can see, here's Markarian 205, and here's NGC 4319. But this is taken from the English countryside in Dorset, which is supposed to be a terrible place to observe. And it's only a 50-centimeter telescope. Now, I have never met these strains, but I'm very, in his Worth Hill Observatory, I'm very impressed by this photograph, which he's obtained with his CCD camera attached to the telescope. And here, you get a very, very good view of the luminous bridge, and even you can even see the central parts, which are coming down in this direction. So of course this poses a very embarrassing question. Why the professional astronomers with billions of dollars worth of equipment in the remote portions of the world on highest mountaintops cannot see this, and the amateurs in the English countryside can. So I like that picture very much. Just a little more information on the nature of quasars and galaxies. This is the center of our local supercluster, the Virgo cluster, and this is an X-ray map. This is just X-rays, and it's smoothed over so you don't see any individual photons. This is M87, a famous galaxy with a jet, which I'll show a little bit later. This is the center of the Virgo cluster, M49, the brightest galaxy. And then this was published in Nature magazine, and it was cut off at this level. And I knew that this stuff went down in this direction, so I got a hold of it as soon as it was published in Nature magazine, and I submitted the rest of the picture, or they call the rest of the story, where it leads down here to this famous, the most famous quasar of all, 3C273. And so I sent it into Nature magazine, and I said, well, since you published this, and it was taken with exactly the same telescope and exactly the same reduction procedures and everything else, because I got the same reduction procedures from the people, and you must publish this showing that this quasar is connected into the local supercluster. And of course they turned it down, so that plan didn't work out very well. But it was published in an alternative journal. And if we want to go to even higher energy, you know, the X-rays are very high energy, and the reason you can pick out the quasars so well is because they're concentrated pieces of high energy. So you pick out the nuclei of the galaxies, the active galaxies, and you pick out the quasars from the X-rays. If you want to go to gamma rays, which are even much higher energy, there are thousands of MeV. The X-rays are a few kilovolts, electron volts. The gamma rays are thousands of MeV. And here is the here's the Virgo cluster in gamma rays. This is another very high, very expensive satellite, gamma ray satellite that was sent up. And here's the center of the Virgo cluster, M49. Here's M87 up in here. Here's 3C273. And here's 3C279, another very bright quasar in the sky, where this is redshift is 0.553. So here you have the very strong energetic rays, and these are going to be the most recent ones, the one that decay fast. I mean, you have to realize that these are very young because they can't go on putting out radiation at this high energy for very long. So the whole two quasars now are connected in to the center of our local supercluster, the Virgo cluster. And the person who worked on this and finally published it against much opposition is now out of the field and doing science writing. He's no longer a research astronomer. However, we did manage to get it published. Well, just some more interesting examples. Here's a galaxy. Oh, this is pretty bad. With hydrogen plumes coming out of it and quasars distributed around and X-ray material coming out along this way. The conventional publications indicated that, in fact, or claimed that the X-ray material was being ejected along the minor axis. And so an amateur in New Zealand sent this warning note to me, and I looked at it, and we got this X-ray map out, which shows the center of this galaxy. It's a big galaxy across here, and this is in X-rays again. The center here pouring a lot of X-rays, and here's an X-ray filament coming out directly out along the minor axis, and here it ends on a quasar redshift 2.15. I consider this to be one of the most direct evidences of local quasars being ejected and so forth. Again, this was turned down by the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, and it's only appeared on the electronic preprint server. Now I want to come to the end of the examples with one recent example, which I find very exciting. And that is, this is number 220 in the Atlas of Peculiar Galaxies. And it's supposed to be one of the most luminous galaxies in the universe. It's called an ultra-luminous infrared galaxy. And people have been observing this and exclaiming over it for a long time. The trouble is they always just observe in here and they never observe in the vicinity and see what else is out around it. Of course, the reason it's ultra-luminous is because, the reason they say it's ultra-luminous is because they, at its redshift distance, if you put it out at that distance and its apparent magnitude, it becomes ultra-luminous. But it never looked to me, as a morphologist, it never looked to me as if it was that distant. And you begin to see these objects in the vicinity here. This has a redshift of 0.02. This is 0.09, so it looks as though these things may be associated. And in fact, if you investigate them, you find that they are associated. And in fact, if you see the radio hydrogen distribution now, you see that the hydrogen distribution comes from the central galaxy down in here and embraces these galaxies of redshift about 27,000 kilometers per second, where this is about 5,000 kilometers per second. But the most exciting observation on this galaxy was this X-ray map. And now you see, just in X-rays, you see the central galaxy, the UL, the ultra-luminous infrared galaxy at a redshift of 0.02. These companion galaxies at a redshift of about 0.1, connected by the X-rays. Then you see a series of X-ray objects moving down here to this blue stellar object, which is an X-ray source, and up to this red stellar object. Now, it's very unusual for a quasar to have a red, to be red, and so I was a little nervous about this. And in June, Margaret Burbage and I were on the Lick telescope, the 3-meter in Mount Hamilton in California, and we had one chance to get this, and it was very faint, and we exposed on it, and I was very nervous about whether these would come out to be quasars, in fact. And in fact, they did come out to be quasars, both of them. And the most extraordinary thing, which we're just working on now, is, and Margaret just sent me these spectra a week ago, the redshifts of this and the redshifts of that are almost identical. You cannot tell the difference. The lines come, carbon 4, carbon 3, magnesium 2 lines come exactly at the same place. So this is to be an extraordinary coincidence if these were not associated. And Margaret is making up a paper to give in the American Astronomical Society. And we'll try to make a press release on it, but I don't know what the chances are of getting any attention to that. This, just for your information, the people who know these galaxies, this is M82, it's a companion to M81. It's taken in the light of hydrogen alpha. And you can see the explosive nature. You can see how this is exploding out in this direction. Here's a piece of gas that's been blown off in this direction. And of course, there's a big history of this too, because it's a bright galaxy and a lot of observations have been made on it. And in the X-rays, it's very interesting. I can just go to the web archives now and pull out the X-ray sources in this region around M82. You know, M81 is down in here, and this is the parent galaxy, and this is the active companion up here. And here are all these X-ray sources stretched out this way. And I won't go into the history of this, but it's known that these are all quasars in here. And the question is, of course, obviously implies that these are quasars up here too, but they're as usual being avoided in to being measured. And just amusing, the one published X-ray map by an observer identified all these point X-ray sources roughly in this direction. We know this one's a quasar. And I wrote to him and I said, well, I'd like to measure these optically to see whether they're quasars or not, or see what their redshifts are. Would you send me the positions? And he wrote back and said, well, no, I can't send you the positions because these are all background sources, and I just eliminated them from the picture. Well, now we have a few minutes for theory. And theory, well, you'll see where I'm making a different approach to the theory than most people, because the conventional theory started in about 1922 with the solution of the Einstein equations, the so-called Friedmann solution. And let's talk about this for a little bit, because this is my attempt to encompass 78 years of theory in one compact slide. And we'll start up here with the Einstein equations of general relativity. G mu nu equals T mu nu, which essentially means that all the energy, kinetic energy, gravitational terms are in this side of the equation, and then this is all the geometrical terms in this side of the equation, the Riemannian space curvature terms and so forth. So the conventional solution, which gives you the Big Bang solution, and which is the solution everybody, or almost everybody, believes in now, the conventional solution, was made by Friedman in 1922, and he found out that the scale, the geometric scale, the spatial coordinates were expanding, either expanding or contracting. And of course, this is the old story about Einstein at first was against this, but then he realized that the redshifts increased as you went to fainter magnitudes, and therefore he said, oh, this is great. This means that my equations are correct and the universe is expanding. And you get a Hubble constant, a certain velocity of expansion increasing as you go out. What I'm saying now, all these observations which I've shown you now, is that it comes up against the brick wall of observations which indicates that the redshifts are not velocity. Because if you get a high redshift and a low redshift, as I've shown in these associations, and they're at the same distance, it can't be an expansion due to distance. So it just is observationally disindicated. I mean, it's forbidden observationally. So we have to go back and say, what is the possible explanation? And we come back up into here, into this assumption that Friedman made when he solved this equation, which was that the particle masses were constant. That is, the protons, the electrons, all these masses were forever the same, and they never changed. There's an alternative solution, a more general solution, which Nalakar made in 1977, Jat Nalakar, and he said, let the mass, particle masses be a function of x and t, but we're concentrating on t, a function of time. And in that case, you get a very simple solution here, which does not involve expansion or motion, whatever. It's that the masses of the elementary particles, they're born with zero mass. The mass is created with zero mass. As time goes on, as a function of t squared, the mass of, say, the electron in the atom increases. And as it increases, the jump that it makes, when it jumps in orbit to emit a photon, that photon gets stronger and stronger. Therefore, the photon starts out in a very young age, in a very young atom, to emit very weak photons, redshifted photons, and then as time goes on, the redshift drops and it becomes like normal matter. And this has, I would, you know, as most theoreticians advertise, my theory does everything, and it has a lot of nice features. It makes the Hubble constant only a function of the age of our own galaxy. So you just take the inverse age of the galaxy, and there's no fudge factors, as in this solution here. You don't put in acceleration parameters and so forth. You get only one chance, and that is H naught. The Hubble constant is the inverse age of the galaxy, and it comes out about 50 kilometers per second per megaparsec, which I think is the correct which is the correct observational answer. Now, it's a non-expanding universe. It's Euclidean. All these terms go to zero. It's a Machian universe, and that is the properties of the matter out at large distance in the universe determine the properties of matter here. As a matter of fact, mass turns out to be essentially a frequency. You have creation points at m equals zero. Instead of singularities in the old solution, where physics just break down, these are the creation points at m equals zero. You have, because you're creating at m equals zero, you're right in the link between quantum and classical physics, something which has never been able to be done in the conventional system. And you have two time scales. I'll talk about that in a following slide. You have a cosmic time and a local time. And you have cascading episodic creation, and you have an indefinitely old and large universe. We could go on at some time about this, but there's a couple more points I want to make. And one is that if this is the solution, and it's in flat space time, universe is Euclidean, then this term here goes to zero. That means we don't have anything like curved space time. And the more I think about curved space time, the more it seems like an oxymoron. It's space is nothing, and how do you curve it? So I'm very happy to get rid of this g mu nu equals d mu nu. But this is the term that the Einsteinians rely on for gravity, because they want to curve have highly curved space-time in order to explain gravity. So you're going to have another explanation for gravity. I don't want to go into that, but I think it's an interesting, a very exciting result of this analysis. To indicate in a rough way the depth of the change that this would indicate. We've gone from observations, just straight observations, just pictures, and just the continuity and the empirical sequence of objects in these pictures, and we've arrived at this evolution, this empirical evolution picture, and so forth, and we've said something about how it could be explained in terms of a theory. And I must say that Nalakar, who was a student of Fred Hoyle's and is a very, very good mathematician, emphasized the fact that his general solution was just a conformal transformation of the special solution, so that his idea is more that, well, the Einstein equations everyone accepts, and since his is a valid solution, and you can transform back to the local Einstein solutions, and you get all the precession of Mercury and all the classical relativistic tests that pass all these, that in fact this is to be preferred. It's a refinement, and it relies on the acceptance of the Einstein equations, because we've just made a more general solution. However, my interest is more on the differences between the normal Einstein solutions, and I've just elaborated them here, listed them down, and I think that they're really very, very fundamental, in the sense that in relativistic physics, you have no prime reference frame, no primary reference frame, and in our solution, you certainly have a primary reference frame, because you have this cosmic time t, and that seems to make sense. I'd say it was a common sense solution, because if you take an average over the universe that you detect, that's your primary reference frame. And I just might comment that as these quasars are ejected, the reason they don't escape is because as the particle masses increase, you see, you start out with a zero mass plasma, which nobody as much as investigated. As the particles increase in mass, they have to conserve momentum in, again, a primary reference frame. That means as the mass goes up, the velocity has to go down, so the particles slow down. And that's what captures them. It's not the gravitational capture, it's this momentum capture. Also, as the velocities, the individual velocities slow down, the kinetic temperature slows down. And that means instead of in the normal system, where a hot plasma would just explode and dissipate, this kind of increasing mass plasma begins to cool, and the gravity then attracts it, and it begins to form atoms, and it begins to form quasars, and it begins to form galaxies. So I think there's a tremendous difference here in this primary reference frame. In the flat Euclidean space, we have in the variable mass, and then this proper time solution is the same kind of solution we're making with two time scales, but other people, these people, have been experimenting and showing that you get the same Einstein results with this set of concepts. So you have a flat Euclidean space. That means you get rid of curved space-time and all the difficulties with that. You have a universal and local time, which you don't have in relativistic physics. It simply means that clocks run fast and slow. If you look at a distant galaxy, it's like their clock is running slow because you're seeing it earlier in its existence. And the clock running slow is just another way of looking at it as redshift. And that causes the redshift. And you have no singularities, that is black holes. Finite, the common sense argument is that finite does not go to infinite. And then there's other aspects of it too. No dark matter in our solution. And finally, you wind up the general conclusion that there's, in the solution which I think that the observations are driving us to, is that there's no Big Bang, no expansion of space, no faster than light inflation, and what you have is a continuous creation of new matter in an indefinitely old and indefinitely large universe. So that's the observations, and this is a little bit of the theory, and I think I'll stop there and invite questions. Thank you. I don't think people would accept the, and I'm not very comfortable either with the violation of the conservation of mass energy. And the way I would visualize it is that the energy is diffused throughout the universe and it materializes at certain points in the nuclei of these galaxies. Fred Hall talks about a negative energy field and so forth, but it's just a sort of a recycling process. And when I talk about creation of new matter, I don't think you can create anything new in the universe because the universe is defined as everything. It's just you're relocating it. The what? M82. Yes. Yes. Well, there's two X-ray things. One is this one. Yes, the redshifts there do that. I agree. There's different. M82 is a bit of a mess, and there's a different. These are different apparent magnitudes, so that relationship is also upset in that particular case. That's why I think it would be very important to get these objects here to see what the redshifts are. And what did you say about 3516?
Mm-hmm.
the redshifts decrease as you go. Yeah. Yeah, well, I would say that there's no clear-cut relationship there, and I think that M82 is a complicated case. I might also say that in the case of 5985, which is almost an exact match for 3516, that I didn't show that slide, but the rate of increase is almost exact. You can take the relationship from 3516 to 5985. So I would say that's the usual relationship, and this is the unusual relationship. Redshift increasing with distance. Decrease. That's what I see in example after example, that as you go out, the redshifts decrease. For example, ARP220, which we saw there, those redshifts in the inner pair were about 1.265, and then there's an outer pair where the redshifts are 2/10 and 4/10. No, the mechanism, what happens in the nucleus, I think, is the great mystery. I mean, that's marvelous. Creates the matter or causes the matter to materialize. Once you get it to materialize in the nucleus, I think that there's a couple things you can say. First of all, the pressure is less along the minor axis because there's a lot of material here. So that has a natural tendency to try and channel it out. Secondly, the matter is probably ionized, well, it's clearly ionized, and the magnetic field is probably to some extent bipolar, so that you're going along the lines of the magnetic field along the minor axis too. So and also this material in the beginning is very low mass, so it's very easy to guide. So I think once you get it in there under pressure, it's got to come out. It'll squirt out preferentially along the minor axis. Yes?
I thought black holes and dark matter have been observed.
No, that's the trouble with dark matter, and that has never been observed. That's very embarrassing. and the reason that people say there's dark matter is because a long time ago they looked at these galaxy clusters and they saw these differences in redshifts, and they said, oh, this means velocity differences, and if there's this much velocity difference, there has to be this huge mass that we don't see. But of course, what we're seeing here in these redshifts of the companion galaxies, we realize there's a component of non-velocity redshift. So that wipes out that whole reason for the dark matter. Then the only one that's left is the flat rotation curves. And the flat rotation curves, we don't want to get into this technicality, I think there's a much better explanation for the flat rotation curves than dark matter, because it requires an exact coincidence of dark matter and the halo matching exactly to the right point and getting the flat out. It's a technical thing. But what? No, black holes. Well, in the first place, it takes an infinity of time to form a black hole. And I've asked my colleagues at lunch, how can we ever see a black hole if it takes an infinity of time to form it? And after thinking for most of the lunch, they say, well, maybe we can never form a black hole, but we can come as close to it as we want to. And so also I think the point is that when you concentrate the matter and more and more energy, it seems dubious that you're going to have collapse. It seems, in general forms, you're going to have that energy that's going to have to burst out, and you're going to have a white hole.
So
I think what they
are identified as black holes.
I think they're white holes.
Yeah. What's a white hole? Sorry.
A white hole is a reversible black hole. I mean, in a black hole, everything falls in, and a white hole, everything falls out. And Fred Hall said a long time ago that it's just time reversal. Mathematically, they're probably quite similar. But again, physically, they're just exactly the opposite.
They're often called near black.
Near black.
Zero.
Yeah.
And that's something that we observe. Some call them black holes, some call them near
holes. Yeah, and some call them white holes.
What is the patient in the serious no longer
Well, I think inside the galaxy, everything is okay, because presumably all the matter, or most of the matter in our galaxy, is about the same age, the same epoch, so that the distances and ages inside our galaxy are all right. There are a few young objects, and this is kind of interesting. Way back in the early 1911, as a matter of fact, 1911, they measured the redshifts of the OB stars, which are the brightest, youngest stars in our galaxy, and they found this mysterious K effect. They had an excess redshift, and they never could explain it, so they've just sort of buried it. But now, if you go back, there's a chapter in my book, In Seeing Red, which shows that you get about a 35, 40 kilometers per second excess redshift, because apparently there was a spread in the age of the creation of matter in our galaxy, so that some of the matter is a little bit younger. Oh, there's lots of... Okay, here. Are all quasars associated with active galaxies? Yeah, that's a question that always comes up. It's certainly possible that a quasar can pass out into the general field. Okay, there's no question about that. But if you ask me that question observationally, I'd say that I think it's possible that most of the quasars could be traced back to their origin, galaxy of origin. Yes?
You showed us, because of the subject that we covered, quasars have been ejected from galaxies. Are other galaxies found the quasars still in them? Or is it just the nucleus as we put it on the one feature that you showed?
Mm-hmm. I think the nucleus is like a quasar. I mean,
it
or a piece of it. Yeah. Although the nucleus that we see is usually of a low redshift, and the matter that we see ejected is usually of a high redshift. So apparently what happens in the very, very center is the mystery.
Yeah.
The conventional approach to this ejection, because they have to face ejection, and it is an accretion disk. And they think of material matter creating, accreting, and then somehow it's blown off in a plume. And I have a lot of criticisms of that particular model, but a lot of my friends work on that model very, very strictly, very stringently. But the big thing is that if you're going to eject enough material to make a new galaxy, you're not going to be able to do it with a conventional accretion disk. That I think everybody would agree on.
Spiral arms of galaxies were also being ejected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, did I understand you right?
Yes. Yes. In matter of fact,
so ejecting stuff all over the place, both as arms. And
Yeah. But if you have an ejection like this, with rotation, it's going to wind up into a spiral. And what I think is that the quasar is ejected out. And it leaves a track and trained material, and it pulls out the magnetic field, so it may store a magnetic guide for ionized material. The ionized material of the galaxy then goes along this tube, the spiral arm being a tube, the condensation takes place, and the new stars are formed in the spiral arm.
There's a sort of great big explosion, and nature thinks some of it is ionized, and if you knew enough about it, you can kind of predict what's going to whiz around where.
Yeah, roughly. Yes? Yes. That goes into the quantization. Maybe I was just worrying about the quantization. Let me show a few slides on quantization, and then we can broaden the discussion. That, now this is the observational evidence. Sometime before this, Jeff Burbidge pointed out this peak at one, redshift 1.96, and then as the observations accumulated, the Swedish astronomer Carlson showed that it obeyed this formula, which gave these peaks. And there was a flaming debate about whether this was right or not, and it's still not accepted. But one of the criticisms of the optical data was that maybe there was some selection effect, that we were just picking quasars at 3.0 and 6.0 because of the way the emission lines came into the bands and so forth. So in this particular analysis, which I did with Professor Chu and B and Zhu and myself, we just took the radio selected quasars, which meant there could be no optical selection in them. And this is in the direction of the local group, and this is the direction of the local supercluster, and you can see the same peaks here, and these are the peaks of the formula. Now the question is, so I think that it's real. I mean, Jeff Burbidge and Napier have another paper on this. The quantization, I think, is really clearly real. The question is, what is it due to? And that's a really tough question. One thing you could say is that maybe things are created periodically in the nuclei galaxy, so they're different age and the age is quantized. And that's one possibility. There's another possibility which has just come up, which is kind of attractive. This is a paper by that Nalkar and I are preparing, and that is if you say that these particles gain mass in a Machian sense as they contact further and further distances in the universe, then they react to the density, so that when they're first created, they're in the nucleus of a galaxy and the density, log of density and solar mass per cubic parsec, is very high. And as soon as they get out of the galaxy nucleus into the galaxy, they drop by a huge order of magnitude. And then when they come out of the galaxy, either out of the bulge of the galaxy, and then out of the galaxy either in the plane this way or along the minor axis this way, they get into the local group density, which is another big step down, and then in the local group to the local supercluster is another big step down. So this is really the hierarchical structure of the universe, the way it's observed. This is a rough this is roughly shows it. But then the quasar, as it ages and its signal reaches out into these different distances, will perhaps drop in these steps. And it's interesting to know there's about six steps and there's about six major quantizations. But while we're on quantizations, let me just throw another monkey wrench into the discussion and broaden it out a little bit. And that is the planetary system. People have pointed out to me that these quasar redshift quantizations have some relationship to the orbital parameters in the planetary system. And here's a very recent development. This is a Titius-Bode's law, which, as you know, blew up at Uranus and at Neptune and Pluto, and was very much denigrated and so forth. But here's a somewhat modification of Bode's law by a man named Walter Murch, and this gives an extraordinary accuracy in the positions of the planets. And you see here's the actual distances here. The actual distances here. Here's predicted by this modification of Bode's law down this way. And the operative thing is that the individual deviation is only 2.43% per orbit. I mean, in each individual orbit. So since you have these six or seven hits that close, it means that it's a very, very good prediction. Now, To further count, now, this is a kind of a doubling law, kind of a harmonic law, two to the nth. And the, so the planets are spaced out like this. And, oh, incidentally, the new planets discovered obey this law also. But to add to the confusion and the mystery and the challenge of it all, I want to show this analysis of the planetary orbits and velocities in the orbits. This is in my book, Seeing Red, and it was sent to me by a pair of Italian physicists, Agnese and Festa, and independently by a French physicist, Natale, and also a physicist from Croatia, from Zagreb. And what you see here is a slightly different fit to the orbital parameters. And this is an n squared law, where the semi-major axis varies as n squared. And right away, you realize an n squared is like a Bohr orbit, where the n is the principal orbit number. And you can see that these numbers 3, 4, 5, and 6, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, fit very well. And then there's the next one out is the asteroids, Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. And this is the semi-major axis fit. And this is the velocity fit. And that's really strange, because the velocities seem to be some factor of 144 kilometers per second divided by n squared. And 144 kilometers per second is a quantization number of the companion galaxies, extragalactic galaxies. However, I can't interpret that 144 kilometers per second periodicity for the companion galaxies as a real velocity, because that would spread out the periodicity and would wash out the periodicity. So I would say that this is totally exciting and totally in confusion, and I welcome your contribution.
I would accept conventional electron, right? I have a few comments from the Earth before. I'm not completely convinced. I think
I would be happy for just partial convincing.
But I think it's fair to say that for those that do not know it, that we observe quasars at large distances, like the general cosmos, because we have evidence for galaxies in front of quasars at large distances. So what we are talking about must be another type of quasar. I would like to see a complete sample as well, as you mentioned. All the quasars, all galaxies selected for some specific reason, and also have a complete sample of quasars in other spheres. But we don't know if they don't exist. But that would be the correct thing to do, to observe quasars around galaxies, select example galaxies from large galaxies. So, I really prove that we have no evidence.
Well, this is, go ahead.
Yeah, and I would also like to see investigation of the quasars you have in the sample show. Look at that spectrum to see if there is really fast, high distances, about distances coming to the galaxies or fiber optic lines. Or do quasars, that would prove that they are actual galaxies. I would also like to see that the investigation of the deficit to the quasars to increase their addresses. And there are other comments as well I would like to make. That concerns the difference between the major galaxies and the companions, and there are other investigations that could samples of exactly galaxies that show that there are no difference in the major galaxy that is active. And I have a comment about bridges. It would be very interesting. I mean, bridges can appear as a position of two of them at different distances. If you could prove that there is a gradual in the direction from the major galaxy to the equation, that would be interesting. But that would show actually something it is changing. The host galaxies, many quasars also have been shown to be hosted by the galaxies. In this sense, it's probably a few, but there are many different quasars, like Lost Eden, so in addition to the absorbing light in the spectrum, we also look for evidence for host galaxies.
Yeah, I mean, let's start from the end and working backwards. I think that this host galaxy business, I've lived with this for 20, 30 years now, and it turns out to be extraordinary. You know, those host galaxies, on the conventional viewpoint, get up to minus 28 absolute magnitude. Just unbelievably, I mean, in terms of what we think a galaxy is. And if you bring them in where I think they should be, you get actually normal galaxies. So I think that host galaxy argument is really strong support for the nearby quasars. As far as the intervening galaxies, the so-called intervening galaxies, that I've talked over with a lot of people on this, and it's very clear that if a galaxy or a quasar is ejecting towards you, you're going to have lower redshift clouds, which are called intervening galaxies. But and also older material will give you lower redshifts too. And then there's a lot of details in there, but I think that argument doesn't actually swings onto the side of nearby quasars. As for the complete samples, that's inadvertently being done now in a very interesting way, and we of this group that are have this, these observations are noticing this and discussing it. Because in the Astrophysical Journal, you're seeing papers now, not one, but two or three papers, four papers coming out and saying, well, we've looked now at the distribution of quasars in this region, and we find that they're concentrated in the direction of low redshift galaxies. And of course, there are different quasar redshifts involved, so you can't say that it's an accidental superposition of a background object. And so these papers are actually saying in the Astrophysical Journal, we're in a bind because we can't explain it by gravitational lensing, which is one of the big ways out. We can't explain it by gravitational lensing. It doesn't look accidental, so, well, we don't know what to do. And these papers are appearing in the Astrophysical Journal. But they won't. They won't say the quasars are nearby.
Well, they're probably based on the data set which are biased towards galaxies. What I mean is that it's difficult to find the data set. So you have
not with the X-rays, because you know the whole sky has been surveyed with X-rays now, and X-rays. There are three main X-ray objects. One is active galaxies, Seyfert galaxies. One is galaxy clusters, and the other is quasars. And so we have very complete X-ray surveys now. And of course, galaxy surveys are complete down to a certain magnitude or a certain region. So even though it might take an infinity of time to make a fully complete sample, I think we have a complete enough sample to make it very compelling. Well, the deep field is so small. It's such a small area. But there's something very interesting in the deep field, and that is, right away, people came to me and said, what do you think about the morphological types in the deep field. And I'd spent a couple, three or four years at Edinburgh looking at 177,000 galaxies or something like this and classifying everything in the UK Schmidt in the Southern Hemisphere. And I said, yes, absolutely. And I mean, it strike you right away that in the bright galaxies, you find 90% normal and 10% abnormal. In the Hubble Deep Field, you find 90% abnormal and 10% normal. And you find these irregular, dwarf-like looking things in the Hubble Deep Field, but they have high redshifts. Now again, the conventional people, Richard Ellis and a whole bunch of them, say, well, these high redshift, strange morphological looking objects in the Hubble Deep Field, because of their redshift, they have to be way out there, and that represents a new class of galaxies. So they're saying, whoop, okay, we have to invent a new class of galaxies. But if these are young galaxies, the way I would interpret them, then they're nearby, and they're not a new class. They're just a young class of galaxies. So I think, again, that the Hubble Deep Field, if you look at it sort of objectively or a priori, is an argument that something's wrong with the conventional picture.
This goes back to Hoyle's kind of analysis. There are really only two fundamental parameters involved: length and mass. And if you make the expressions of the Compton frequency, you see you can express the mass of an object as a frequency, and so mass at a certain created at a certain epoch is going to have a certain characteristic frequency. It's a clock rate. It's the inverse. The frequency is the inverse of the clock rate, and for the newly created matter, the clock rate is running very, very slow, so the frequency is very low. And then as the mass increases, the frequency goes up and the redshift drops. So if you want to fasten, the remark just means, if you want to fasten on one fundamental parameter, then you can use frequency. Oh yeah, I think it must be some kind of resonant state, unless it's reflecting these steps in the hierarchical distribution of density in the matter, and that's a resonant state. Yeah, and if you think of it in terms of frequency, then it's certainly a resonant state.
Question
at
the back.
Yeah, well, I steer away from the term infinite. I'm saying an indefinitely large, indefinitely old universe. But you bring up a very interesting point in the sense that if you don't take the redshift as a distance indicator in extragalactic astronomy, then you say, well, what are the furthest galaxies that we know for sure, that we know their distance? And I would say, from my observational experience, that the only ones we're sure of are out to the local supercluster, which is 20 megaparsecs. Now, there may be distant galaxies which are out there, but a lot of this stuff that we think is far out is really in the local supercluster, and I'm not sure that there's much outside the local supercluster. It might actually be a big trough and might go out indefinitely, or maybe there's another big concentration way out. I just think that just as you get out far enough, your uncertainty goes up and up. Let's see, I better turn it over to you. You're in a better position to pick out people than I am.
We've got to draw to a close. Is there a final question?
I just wanted to say your book has been reviewed in the latest British Astronomical Association reviewed by an amateur astronomer, Jack, and says that he uses the adjective weird, and then he says not according to the party line. Yet he also says if this work must be seriously followed up. I wonder, have you got
This is the thing we discuss all the time, and I only can say that hope springs eternal. As some of you know, I just came back from a discussion with Fred Hoyle, and I was showing Fred the newest results on ARP-220, and he said, okay, now this has to establish the fact that these high and low redshift objects are at the same distance, and this may be the one that does it. But then I have to remember that he said this about previous observations, too. And that is the big question. When or if or when the astronomical leadership will recognize this as a legitimate area of research.
Let's ask a final, quite important question. Are you absolutely sure that, you know, with photographic emulsions, as they used to be, you get irradiation of image spread. Can you be absolutely certain that these apparent bridges aren't just an artifact caused by bright objects, like the teardrop effect?
Yeah, I think having spent my whole life doing photography and imaging, I know the checks and balances that you have to take, different telescopes, different emulsions, different wavelengths, and if you see the same thing again and again, if it walks like a duck, it probably is a duck.
So we'll break now until 1:45. The light sheet tells you some local places where you can get food. We can't, but there isn't quite nowhere within this building that supplies food, but there's quite a few nearby. If you want to know more about what we've talked about this morning, to follow up the point, the books, particularly Seeing Red, is details are given on the attached sheet. So finally, once again, let's thank Paul Pinnard for conducting the most stimulating